There's nothing the country cured with a wink and a fart, and you're listening to WGXC in Accra, 90.7 FM.
Network, this is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
I'm Tom Rowe in Accra, and you've tuned into the WGXC Morning Show. Today we will hear from Maggie Hazen from the Columbia Collective about their show Talking Back, Artists of the Columbia Collective, which runs through this weekend at Foreland in Catskill and features local incarcerated artists. We will also hear music from the Golden Palominos featuring drummer Anton Fear, who was announced died yesterday. We'll also hear the national headlines from the Public News Service and the local Better Weather from the Catskill Maker Syndicate. And it all starts after Jason Martin finishes singing this song, and then the local news is on the WGXC Morning Show. Stay tuned.
Connection and the moon turns to blood. A stream runs through. This is the network. Network.
This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
And the moon turns to blood.
Turn out or tune in to two of the world's greatest percussionists performing in Catskill at the Avalon Lounge on October 16th from 8 to 10 p.m. Composers and percussionists Tatsuya Nakatani and Bobby Previtt perform with a live web stream at WGXC.org. Turn out or tune in for Tatsuya Nakatani and Bobby Previtt performing at the Avalon Lounge in Catskill on Sunday, October 16th from 8 to 10 p.m. Find out more in the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org.
Wave Farm programs are made possible in part by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program, administered in Greene County by CREATE, the Alexander and Marjorie Hoover Foundation, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors, including WGXC's sustaining supporters, who provide critical monthly support to Wave Farm's radio station, WGXC 90.7 FM. Thank you. Wave Farm's WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Delmar Wellness Center of Alaysia, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to WGXC.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station.
Stand by for news.
Direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is
Daily News and Weather Report.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. I'm Philip Grant.
This is Tom Rowe. You can go to the newsroom at WGXC.org for more information about anything you hear here.
CNN is reporting that New York Attorney General Letitia James filed a lawsuit September 21st against former President Donald Trump, three of his adult children, and the Trump Organization, alleging an expansive fraud lasting over the past decade. The more than 200-page lawsuit alleges fraud in many aspects of the Trump business, including his properties and golf courses. According to the lawsuit, the Trump Organization deceived lenders, insurers, and tax authorities by inflating the value of his properties using misleading appraisals. The lawsuit states, and I quote, "These acts of fraud and misrepresentation were similar in nature were committed by upper management at the Trump Organization as part of a common endeavor for each annual statement and were approved at the highest levels of the Trump Organization, including by Mr. Trump himself, end quote. Besides the former president, Donald Trump Jr., Eric Trump, and Ivanka Trump are also named as defendants in the lawsuit, as is Alan Weisselberg, former CEO for the Trump Organization, and Jeff McCooney, another longtime company executive. James also referred the matter to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York and the Internal Revenue Service, as she believes state and criminal laws may have been violated. The lawsuit seeks $250 million in allegedly ill-gotten funds and to permanently bar Trump and others named in the lawsuit from serving as a director of a business registered in New York State. Read the full story at the CNN website.
Roger Hannigan-Gilson reports in the Times Union that an affordable housing developer has proposed building three structures in Hudson with a combined total of 85 units in an effort to ease the housing crisis. The buildings will be developed by the Kearney Realty and Development Group in conjunction with the nonprofit Hudson River Housing. The project will consist of 60 mixed-income rental units on Mill Street, 21 mixed-income rental units with additional commercial spaces at 4th and Warren Streets, and a duplex on Rossman Avenue with two attached apartments. The plan was kept under wraps until it was presented to the Hudson Common Council during a special meeting on September 20th. Representatives from Kearney said during the meeting the apartments would be rented at prices deemed affordable to households making between 30 and 110% of the area median income, which, in 2022, is equivalent to between $26,000 and $97,600, according to federal data. Construction would include green building techniques, according to Kearney Vice President Sean Kearney. The completed units would use geothermal heat and rooftop solar panels. The developers will not apply to the city for tax breaks. Kearney will ask the state that the units be valued according to the income they produce, as opposed to how much they cost to build, which would result in a lower assessed value and lighter taxes. Kearney anticipates his company will be able to submit plans to the city's planning board this winter or by spring, hoping to get ready before the state's deadline for tax credit applications. The developers believe construction will be completed and the units ready to be occupied in the spring of 2024. Read more about this story in the Times Union.
Ted Remsnyder reports for Columbia Green Media that the unmasked masses at Columbia County Fair last month may have contributed to an uptick in COVID-19 cases locally. The Columbia County Department of Health also says an outbreak at Grand Rehabilitation and Nursing at Barnwell in Valencia is partially to blame. Columbia County Department of Health Director Jack Knapp said in a statement, and I quote, "I think this is likely driven by the very contagious Omicron and BA5 variants of the virus that have worked their way through the facility." Barnwell has been moving the positive cases into a separate wing and have been dealing with this in a positive fashion, end quote. Columbia County reported 28 new positive cases on September 19th and 72 active cases, with 12 county residents hospitalized and a pair in intensive care due to COVID-related illnesses as of September 16th. Four of those cases are employees having worked the department's booth at the county fair. Mab said September 19th, and I quote, "There's no real science here because we don't know exactly where they got it, but the timing was such that it's pretty fair chances that some of them got exposed working the booth. There are some events at the fair that can be natural spreaders. There's the firemen's parade, where they assemble afterwards in a tent and spend a couple of hours there. Our booth is in the main fair house, which is an old, beautiful building, but it has no real modern circulation of air, and there's an awful lot of people who pass through there," end quote. Greene County officials reported another COVID-19 death September 16th. An unidentified woman was in her 70s who had received two doses of COVID-19 vaccine at the time of her death. There are COVID vaccination clinics at the A.B. Shaw Fire Department in Claverick on Thursdays in September from 3 p.m. to 5:30 p.m. And you can read the full story at HudsonValley360.com.
Mid-Hudson News is reporting that in June, international flights returned to New York Stewart International Airport. Play Airlines is flying every day to its hub in Iceland, where travelers are able to access dozens of mainland European cities. Alex Minton, the Port Authority's passenger development director, told the Stewart Airport Commission on September 20th that thousands of travelers used the Newburgh Airport in the first month of Play's service. Airport officials said July and August were also, quote, very strong months, unquote, for Play Airlines at Stewart. Quote, Play carried over 5,000 passengers between Stewart and destinations throughout Europe. We know that some of the top markets for customers that are traveling between Europe and Stewart and the other direction are not surprisingly are Paris, Dublin, and London. Berlin and Copenhagen are also popular destinations, unquote, Minton said. Read more about this story at MidHudsonNews.com.
Andrea Makel reports in Porcupine Soup that Pamela Jess is now executive director and president of Greene County's Chamber of Commerce. Jess has been filling the role on an interim basis since Jeff Friedman left the job, which was announced last month. Greene County Chamber of Commerce Board of Directors Chair Nicole Bliss said, and I quote, Pamela comes from the world of advertising and marketing. She has over 30 years of experience as a multimedia executive, including director of advertising and marketing at various newspaper media companies, including Columbia Greene Media, Ulster Publishing, Saugerties Post State, and the Daily Freeman, end quote. For the past 4 years, Gesk has been the Chamber's membership director. Friedman left the post after almost a decade of leading the organization to focus on his family's business. Read the full story at Porcupine Soup.
Ted Remsnyder reports for Columbia Greene Media that the new Lebanon Central School District is preparing to install a water filtration system to treat the drinking water supply at its junior-senior high school to resolve the problem of elevated levels of PFOS. New Lebanon Superintendent Andrew Court announced on January 28th that the PFOS levels in the drinking water supply at the school had been measured at 11 parts per trillion, greater than the State Department of Health limit of 10 parts per trillion. The district then began working with the state and county on a compliance schedule to reduce the levels of contaminant. Quote, the Columbia County Department of Health very recently approved a filtration system that will be attached to the junior-senior high school water supply, unquote, Court wrote. Quote, this project will cost over $100,000 and will have to be purchased by the district using funds from this year's budget, unquote. Court said the project is currently out for bid and school officials are hopeful that it will start in the coming weeks. District tests now show the school water supply is testing within average levels for PFOS. Quote, even with these lower levels, the district is still required to install an elaborate filtration system to permanently remedy these fluctuating water levels, unquote, Court wrote to district parents. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com.
Alex Galt reports for Northern New York newspapers that the National Rifle Association has given Representative Elise Stefanik an A+, and given her opponent, Democrat Matt Castelli, an F, and he is upset about his grade. Castelli, a former CIA officer and director of counterterrorism at the National Security Council, who served in both the Obama and the Trump White Houses, says he is a gun owner, and he says he would not support a ban on assault weapons sales that many Democrats are talking about in Congress. According to the Adirondacks Enterprise, at a September 14th town hall meeting, Castelli said he prefers legislation to keep all weapons out of the hands of those who would use them to harm others, people he defined as, and I quote, cop killers, kid killers, domestic abusers, and terrorists, end quote. Castelli also said he opposes the recent gun control legislation passed in New York. He says the National Rifle Association never asked him anything about his position on guns and cannot understand why they would give him an F grade. He said, and I quote, the NRA is misleading the public with the claim that they rank political candidates based on voting records, public statements, and their response to an NRA PFV questionnaire. The corrupt NRA has abandoned its original values of responsible gun ownership, cut funding to gun training and safety, and now represents corporate interests, not law-abiding gun owners, end quote. Castelli is challenging Stefanik in New York's 21st Congressional District, which includes Rensselaer County, in the election October 29th through November 8th. And you can read the full story at NNY360.com.
Rebecca F. Ward reports in the Times Union that the growing season may be just about over, but as of October 5th, patients who use medical cannabis in New York can grow up to 3 mature plants and 3 immature plants at home. The announcement comes from the Cannabis Control Board, which approved the final home cultivation rules on September 20th. Anyone without medical certification will need to wait until the state's commercial cannabis marketplace opens to grow at home. That could be later this year or early in 2023. In addition to the plants, medical patients can possess up to 5 pounds of cultivated cannabis. In New York, medical patients won't be able to sell what they grow, but can give up to 3 ounces of cannabis or 24 grams of concentrated cannabis to another certified patient or caregiver. New York currently has 124,485 registered medical cannabis patients and 3,817 practitioners approved to certify them. Read more about this story in the Times Union.
And that wraps up the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, and other community information, use the WGXC website, WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day. And now, here is your WGXC weather update. Your forecast for the next 2 days. Well, on Thursday, showers are likely, possibly a thunderstorm before noon, then a chance of showers after that. Otherwise, it will be cloudy, then gradually becoming mostly sunny with a temperature high near 67 degrees. Thursday night, partly cloudy with a temperature low of around 43 degrees. And on Friday, mostly sunny with a high near 57 degrees. And Friday night, mostly clear with a temperature low of around 43 degrees. And that is your weather update from WGXC. 90.7 FM, radio for open ears in Greene and Columbia counties.
Tune in to all sorts of creative community voices on the radio on WGXC on Thursday, September 22nd, including at 9 a.m. on the WGXC Morning Show. We will speak live with Maggie Hazen from the Columbia Collective about their show Talking Back, Artists of the Columbia Collective, that is up at Foreland in Catskill through September 25th. Then at 10 a.m., it's time for Cheryl Kay's Situation Fluxus show. Jazz show this week features bassist Levi Dover, composer Jenatine MG, and drummer Louis Vincent Hamill on the radio at 90.7 FM. Then at 2 p.m., it's time for What's the Frequency, Kenneth? It's all about migrants, midterms, Mars, and Mar-a-Lago this week. And then turn on the news at 3 p.m. At 4 p.m., it's time for the WGXC Afternoon Show live from Hudson with Tom DiPietro and Cello Graham. At 7 p.m., it's time for Chris Funkhauser's Poet Radio Show. And at 8 p.m., it's time for Neva Wartell's Music for the Masses, this week interviewing Ivy Hess, the co-executive director of the Columbia County Sanctuary Movement, which holds its 5th anniversary event on October 8th and is speaking about National Hispanic Heritage Month, among other issues. And at 10 p.m., Ted Barron has the Boogie Woogie Flu live from the WGXC Hudson Studio in the basement of the First Presbyterian Church on Warren Street on 90.7 FM WGXC.
Get a local event mentioned on All Together Now. Go to WGXC.org and click on Add an Event at the top of the page. And copy and paste the information about your event in the boxes. Let's all get involved in our community. See what's going on at WGXC.org in the community calendar.
On Saturday, October 22nd, come out to Wave Farm and view the installations. It's part of WGXC's Fall Pledge Drive. Noon to 6 p.m. on Saturday, October 22nd, Wave Farm will welcome drop-in visitors for tours of the campus, including the WGXC Acre Studio and the many installations on the property that employ radio in some way. Also, community members and local nonprofit organizations can come by to record public service announcements to air on 90.7 FM, and members of the public can record a station ID for WGXC. Again, that's Wave Farm is open for visits on Saturday, October 22nd during the WGXC Fall Pledge Drive from noon to 6 p.m. Go to WGXC.org for more information, and we'll see you on Saturday, October 22nd at Wave Farm.
This is Mitch McConnell when I'm up in the Catskills to go hunt bear and visit my friends in the Greene County Legislature. I always tune into WGXC. I love that weird show, the Nothing Is Real Radio Hour, but it's not on very often. What a bunch of crazy Yankees up there. Where is that station again? Oh, now, remember, it's at 90.7 FM on the dial in my Lexus. I wish we had something like that in Kentucky. Don't forget to vote, y'all.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Thursday, September 22nd. Local early morning temperatures range from 64 in Durham to 69 in Rhinebeck. If you can hear my voice and possibly the rain going on in the background, then it is still summer. Unless they rebroadcast after 9:03 p.m., because that is when it officially becomes fall. Today is the equinox. Near the foot of the mountains, you will experience a pretty evenly split night and day. Elsewhere in New York, you will have a little more than 12 hours of light due to the atmosphere gently bending those photons down towards us. For the actual even split, that happens on Sunday. And we are currently losing 2 minutes and 49 seconds of light per day. The loss will slow down as we head towards winter. And this fall, in general, is looking to be relatively dry and warm. However, that being said, today is going to be wet and cool. Rain persists from this morning into the afternoon, calming down around 2 p.m. Temperatures will fluctuate today, starting at 65 degrees, dropping to 62 as the cold front rolls through. Then it will bounce back, hitting 67 degrees around 3 p.m. After dark, rain chances cease and we watch the mercury drop to 44 degrees. Tomorrow is looking even cooler but dry. We see a high of 60 at 3 p.m. 42 degrees overnight takes us into a windy Saturday with a high of 68. Overnight, winds calm and we see a low of 47. Sunday looks to have a high of 68 and a rainy afternoon. Pollen levels for today will be low, but we're keeping a watch out for you ragweed sufferers. Today's tide schedule is high tide at 1:09 a.m., low tide at 7:51 a.m., high tide again at 1:45 p.m., and low tide once again at 7:51 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 71 degrees, and the tide strength will be average. Sunset today will be at 6:41 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 6:38 a.m. Remember, times are always corrected for the mountains. Or at least being in the shadow of the mountains. Looking way up, we see flare chances are up today. 30% chance of M-class flares and 5% chance of X-class flares. Solar wind speed is currently 403 kilometers per second at 3.2 protons per milliliter. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair below 8 MHz till dark, then fair across the board overnight. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 2, quiet. The current sunspot number is 70, and this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Ellen Donovan of Medusa, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. Thank you for your support.
I'm Cheryl Kay, host of the Jazz Disturbance on WGXC, 90.7 FM, listener-supported radio for open ears in upstate New York. The Jazz Disturbance features jazz and other improvised music. Tune in on the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 5th Sunday of each month from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on 90.7 FM, wavefarm.org/listen, tune in, and on the Wave Farm Radio app on your smartphone. Playlists are posted at facebook.com/CKDisturbance.
Now to absorb some local color through the magic of AM radio.
The book of Revelations tells us to watch for the seven signs of evil.
Sign of evil number 4.
Continuing our sign of evil countdown, here's Vanessa Williams.
Thank you. Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
I am announcing that today we are filing a lawsuit against Donald Trump for violating the law as part of his efforts to generate profits for himself, his family, and his company.
New York Attorney General Letitia James filed a civil lawsuit against former President Donald Trump and his family business Wednesday, alleging Trump, three of his adult children, and two longtime company executives fraudulently overvalued assets by billions of dollars. James said Trump and the other defendants used more than 200 false valuations on annual financial statements over 10 years. Speaking before the United Nations General Assembly, President Biden sharply condemned Russia's invasion of Ukraine, saying the military offensive should make the world's blood run cold.
Permanent member of the United Nations Security Council invaded its neighbor, attempted to erase a sovereign state from the map.
Biden spoke just hours after Russian President Vladimir Putin warned he might use nuclear weapons if threatened and announced plans to call up 300,000 reservists to aid in his country's war effort. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell announced the third straight interest rate hike in an effort to control high inflation, now at a 40-year high.
We have got to get inflation behind us. I wish there were a painless way to do that. There isn't.
The central bank raised rates by 0.75 percentage point for a total of 3 full percentage points this year, despite concerns the rate hikes could increase unemployment or send the economy into a recession. The House Homeland Security Committee Wednesday held a hearing on America's aging infrastructure and the role environmental racism plays when allocating federal aid. Committee Chairman Benny Thompson of Jackson, Mississippi, said his city, which recently suffered a critical failure in its drinking water system, is not alone.
In fact, of the water systems that consistently violate federal drinking water standards, 40% of them serve communities of color.
Thompson said studies show black and brown communities are likely to bear the brunt of natural disasters. The House advanced a bill to overhaul the Electoral Count Act, which determines how state and Congress certify electors and declare the winner of presidential elections. New York Representative Hakeem Jeffries said democracy cannot run on autopilot.
Particularly because we are confronting a diabolical adversary who is determined to undermine the principle of free and fair elections.
Finally, the Senate ratified an international agreement to limit the use of hydrofluorocarbons, the toxic greenhouse gases used in refrigerators and air conditioning. Production and use of the gases will be phased down 85% over the next 14 years. For Public News Service, I'm Catherine Carley. Find our 8 trust indicators for transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. President Biden spoke September 20th about dark money in our elections and voiced his support of the Disclose Act, which is expected to be voted on this week in the U.S. Senate. What is the Disclose Act, and why should voters support this campaign finance legislation? Current campaign finance law prohibits foreign entities from contributing in U.S. elections, but both domestic and foreign contributors have used 501c3 and 501c4 nonprofits and limited liability shell corporations to hide the source of hard-to-trace dark money donations. If passed, the Disclose Act prohibits foreign contributions and would require donations above $10,000 from domestic corporations, unions, or other political organizations to be disclosed within 24 hours. The bill also expands current election law to prohibit foreign entities from making contributions supporting or opposing judicial nominations or ballot initiatives. It establishes penalties and possible jail time for those who attempt to conceal the contributions. And it would require disclaimers on political ads to reveal the largest contributors to the organization who ran the advertising. The Disclose Act has been proposed and failed in previous sessions and may fail again. Republicans like Senator Ted Cruz argue that anonymous donations allow corporations to fully express their First Amendment rights. Find links at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. For the American Democracy Minute, I'm Brian Beal.
Next, we hear 2022 music from Spoon, the Adrian Sherwood reconstruction of the song on the radio at 90.7 FM.
Tragic is
that game, John Britt.
Are now joined by Maggie Hazen. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yep, that's correct.
From the Columbia Collective, who has a show up at Foreland in Catskill through this weekend. It ends September 25th, so you still have a chance to see Talking Back, artist of the Columbia Collective. And I guess, Maggie, can you start by explaining to listeners what the Columbia Collective is?
Yeah, the Columbia Collective is, first off, I'm an artist, and so the group that I formed called the Columbia Collective is a group of artists, but who are young and incarcerated at the Brookwood Secure Center in Claverack, New York, near Hudson. It's called the Columbia Collective because they were first incarcerated at the Columbia Secure Center for Girls, and then were moved to Brookwood right next door, which is the boys' facility, when Columbia Secure Center shut down in last August. So we call it Columbia Collective because that's where it started. And right now we are a collective of like three artists who are between the ages of 16 and 20. And then there are a few who have left the facility who've been in contact with me who are also members of the collective as well, who were once incarcerated at Columbia.
And WGXC did a program with incarcerated youth before the pandemic. And so we know exactly how difficult it is to do anything, but why don't you explain to listeners how difficult it is to the bureaucracy, the rules are all very, very strict, and it's almost impossible to do the sort of thing that you're doing.
Yeah, it is extremely difficult. The two things that I've learned from working with them since 2019 is persistence and being consistent. Like, that's really what it takes. Because the system, you know, working with the administrative stuff is just so hard. I mean, there's a key for every door. Every incarcerated person has to like have a staff with them and to go into different rooms. And so like the administrative staff is always over their heads, the people that are in over their heads with how much stuff is on their plate. And so it's just me sending a lot of emails, me showing up, being turned away. But yeah, the logistics of all of navigating the facility is, I actually find quite fascinating, because I kind of approach it as like a generative principle in some way. Like those constraints kind of help, they direct my path. They kind of give me the limitations of what I can and can't do. And so I'm not allowed to share the names of the artists that I work with at the facility or their faces. So we use that as generative. So every artist in the collective has a fake name or a pen name they go by. We have Jay, Juste, and Marshmallow, and all of them have a very unique style and identity. They brand themselves with their own logo, and we feature that on the website, as well as their, like, galleries of their artwork. So that's sort of, like, ways we're trying to, like, work around the rules of the system.
And did you bring in art supplies, and was that a difficult process?
Yeah, so I'm able to bring in quite a few art supplies. I have to write a gate clearance for everything, so every little item I bring in, I have to take note of. There's things that I'm not allowed to bring in, but the wing that I work on, they're pretty, a little bit more relaxed, even though it is a maximum secure facility. So, but there's things I can't bring in, like pens, for instance. So I've had to bring in, like, soft tip markers or things like that.
And how are the participants, are they chosen by the staff there, or do they volunteer, or how does that work?
So it sort of just grew organically. I really let it grow organically. It's more of like who's interested. So the artists I work with are girls, and we have a trans artist as well, who we're all at the Columbia Secure Center. So I've had relationships with them for anywhere from between like 2 and 3 years. I start out with teaching something, but I don't like this top-down method. I like it to be very collaborative, so I can just kind of work individually and one-on-one. So they're not really chosen. They're sort of, it just happened that the three that I've been working with consistently have been the three that have been at the Secure Center the longest, and they're all just really naturally talented and gifted in the arts already. So I feel like I'm just there to cultivate their voices and help give them a platform.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Some of them had done artwork before?
Yeah, so a lot of them like already enjoyed art making. Two of the artists, Marshmallow and Jay, were already naturally drawing, and I'd been helping them improve, work on their drawing skills and thinking through how to like expand their medium. But Just A really wasn't confident in a lot of her art making, but soon she grew and discovered like she really loved it and got really into paper mache and really into writing, and a lot of her work really like sold opening night at the opening, and she was like, whoa, I never knew I could do this. I never knew I could be an artist. So it all sort of happens organically. No one's really chosen. It's sort of just the numbers that I've working with on the unit. So everybody gets the opportunity to be a part, and then they can choose to participate or not.
And people say artists often work with what they see, like the impressionists, all these fields. Is their art based on their experience in the facility, or do they use their imaginations to create whole other worlds, or is it a combination? What is it like that way?
Yeah, sort of a combination between the two. I think it depends on who the artist is. Like Marshmallow is really into surrealism, and she kind of makes work that escapes her experience of being in the facility, which really they're just all stuck in the same unit with each other 24/7 with, rare trips off the unit, maybe once a day or so. To another classroom. So she's probably not focused on her reality in the way that like the works of Jay and Just A are. They really make work that's responding to the environment that they're in. And you can kind of see it in their like realistic like reinterpretations of the artworks, like making a clock or making a walkie-talkie. you know, things that, you know, they make there's two of those papier-mâché pieces in the show. And, yeah, they're just making work from what's observing the reality and, like, trying to really process it. So it's, everybody sort of has a different way of coping with the or working through or working with the trauma that the system, you know, brings to their experiences.
And tell us something about the I'm guessing, you know, art typically has a transformative nature, and I'm also guessing that these participants don't have a lot of leisure activities other than this program. I mean, they probably do some work in the facility, and but they don't go out to parties, and they don't do go to parks and enjoy nature. So was the art transformative? Did you see changes over the course of working with them?
Oh, yeah, I definitely, like, seen them change throughout the course of my time working with them because, yeah, they are not given much. You're exactly right in terms of, like, they don't get exposed to many people. And so I think a lot of where I've seen some of them transform is their response to the programming. Like, they're all kind of nonchalant in their own way. But when it's art time, they're like, oh, yeah, art's cool. You know, they kind of downplay it a little bit. But, like, you know that they're talking about it to everyone else when they're not doing anything. So I've seen it, like, how it sort of has awakened them. And the fact that people are listening to them and seeing their artwork at the show at Forlin in Catskill, like, and people, like, Chronogram has written about it and Times Union has written about it. And, like, people can leave notes at the gallery in response to the artwork that they are seeing. And so this feedback to them is super important. I see, like, how, like, it's so validating to be like, oh, my gosh, I'm heard. Somebody's listening to me. Somebody likes my work. I'm good at something. And so it's, like, channeling this in and, like, really it speaks so loudly to them because they literally are not, yeah, like you said, doing much. So I've seen that transform them. It's, like, through validation and through, like, seeing people listening. So.
They probably have televisions. Do they have those clear radios that are in some of the other prisons? And we get some letters from the Coxsackie prisoners saying they listen to the station. So is it possible they hear this story about themselves?
That's awesome. Wait, what was your question? Sorry.
Do they have radios even?
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah, they don't have radios, but they do have a TV that they watch, like, local broadcasting on that is censored. And then there's a
so they can't watch Law and Order.
No, they do actually watch a lot of prison shows. Ironically, It's sort of a feedback loop. but they have an Xbox. So there's a lot of video gaming, a lot of Minecraft.
Do they censor the kinds of video games they're allowed to play?
Yeah, I think so for the most part.
No Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah, probably not. It's more like a. Yeah, I haven't looked at their video games they have yet, but I know they play Minecraft. I've seen them play that.
And the show at Foreland, was it just everything they worked on, or did the partway through the program did you say, well, we're going to work on this theme? Or start telling us about the show at Foreland that's called Talking Back, Artists of the Columbia Collective. And it's through this Sunday, right? September 25th?
Yes. It's open through Sunday. Or it's open this weekend, Saturday and Sunday.
So what is the artwork like in there?
Yeah, so the show Talking Back, Artists of the Columbia Collective, is all of their work. Well, some of it, you know, is chosen by our curator, Sophia D'Amico, who is a recent graduate from the Bard Curatorial Studies Program. And so I brought her in to also, you know, meet with the artists to know about their work. And so Sophia curated the entire exhibition and wrote two really fantastic essays about the artists and about juvenile incarceration in the Hudson Valley, which anybody can access through our website. It's a free PDF. But, it's artwork that really is just translating their experiences. Some artwork was in there, some isn't. But for the most part, it's just a collection of their works. And then Sophia brought everything together through the theme of Talking Back, which is based off of a bell hooks novel from 1989, I think.
And I know, writing about music is like dancing about architecture. Talking about art is difficult, but can you describe some of the works that people might see if they head to Foreland?
Yeah, you'll see a lot of drawings, a lot of 2D-based mediums, because that's the most accessible thing we can do in the facility. So a lot of charcoal drawings from Jay that were made out of his sketchbook. There are some banners that they worked on digitally with Photoshop, and then I printed them out digitally. And, so there's a mixture of things. And there's a lot of really popular papier-mâché objects. So those objects are sort of like objects that they've wanted to make, but a lot of them have kind of translated from their experiences in the facility. So we have like a clock, a broom, a radio, there's a bunch, a telephone, stuff that they see in the environment. But a lot of the work, like, it's really image-based. We're only able to do, like, papier-mâché as sculpture, so that's where there's a lot of that. And there's also a reading room in part of the gallery space, too, where visitors can come and pick up a book and read about some other various voices talking about issues within, our carceral system.
And stylistically, you mentioned this work was surreal before. What different styles are they using?
Yeah. So Marshmallow works with a lot of color, really vibrant color. There's a lot of eyeball motifs that pop up in her work, and you get to, like, I think it's sort of like her way of processing her dreams. And she says, like, she has a very lucid imagination. And so she comes up with a lot of interesting visions, she says, at night when she's, like, going to sleep. She has a very active mind. And so I think there's something about the eyeball that she's focused on in her work and her process. And then, like, Jay's work tends to be very, like, very dark. There's a lot that he's working through in processing. And there's a bit, he likes the dark black and white with a little bit of color popping through, to sort of evoke like this other emotional state through, the light shift in the darkness.
And I believe I saw that there was a talk as part of the show last week. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, so we had a panel discussion where we invited Mark Longhi, who was an artist who was incarcerated in Philadelphia. I forget what prison, but his artwork was in this MoMA PS1 show in New York City called Marking Time, and Artist in the Age of Mass Incarceration. And he spoke about his drawings and stuff that he did while he was serving time. He's released now and on parole, so he joined us via Zoom. We had Allison Cornyn and Cynthia Boykin from the Incorrigibles Project, which is a project that focuses on the archival histories of the Hudson Training School for Girls, which was sort of a place where, quote, incorrigible young women would go. And so the whole project's about the definition of that name and how we define those, especially young people who are incarcerated, and how those identities stick.
That girls' school, like, that dates back like a century or something, isn't it? Wasn't it?
Yeah, and Ella Fitzgerald was there.
Right, yeah. There was a play in Chatham, I think, about that a couple years ago, I remember hearing about.
Yeah. I think they're also making a movie about it, but I don't know much. so they were in conversation with each other, and then we had an impromptu guest that asked us if they could actually be a part of the panel the day before. His name is Luke, and he works with the Hudson Catskill Housing Coalition. And apparently, he was formerly incarcerated at the Brookwood Secure Center. So we had a lot of interesting conversation going on about that. That felt very local. And
he got to actually tell what it's like inside.
Yeah. So he talked, and while he was talking about his time at Brookwood, He has a very activist personality as well, and so it was great to have him on. While he was talking, he was making a rose out of toilet paper, because he said, while he was locked up for 3 years, They learned how to make, he learned how to like use the fine sheets of a single toilet, like toilet paper sheet, to roll up into like a rose. And he left that in the galleries for us to see.
So without this program, that's the main medium of art that goes on in prisons, right?
Yeah, sort of like stuff you find around you. Is that what you're...
Yeah, yeah. They have very few materials to work with.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I've been lucky that I've been able to bring in like more art supplies, probably than an adult maximum secure center. But yeah, we just have to use a lot of what's around us. And there's always a fight for paper towels. There's definitely a scarcity there.
Hmm. And it's hard to quantify this, but what sort of impact do you think this program has on these participants?
Yeah, I mean, it's a range. I mean, I have the sort of testimony of one formerly incarcerated artist. I can say her name because she's out now, is Marilyn. And she contacted me, she got out in 2020 and contacted me a couple months after she was released, and found my email and got in touch with me, and we built a relationship, actually, like a mentorship. And so she said that the program has like really helped her a lot, and she is really interested in being an artist and wants to try to pursue that. And so I'm currently helping her work on college applications. So I don't know. I think like for me, the impact that I really care about is the really like the deeper personal connections, rather than like, you know, this mass of people and like who, like how many people are you reaching? It's more for me about like the locality of individuals and cultivating time with them. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that there's a larger impact going on that, you know, internally with them that I can't fully see yet.
And do you think some of them may continue doing art afterwards, or how do you think the impact will be when they get out?
Yeah, I'm hoping that they all continue to do work. I think a lot of them are super talented and have been encouraged to like pursue art practices, like if they want to go to college. But they're a little bit worried about like the financials about it. You know, like the main question is like, can I make money, you know, doing my artwork? You know, and I've struggled I have 2 degrees in sculpture. You know, it's not like I went to like business school. So I try to like help them think about creative ways of applying their art skills in different contexts, you know, that can help them also think about like a job and about like the practicals of like everyday life too.
And they actually have a resume has begun, right? They've shown work in at Foreland.
Yep, exactly. So like that sort of is like a measurable impact there. Like, yeah, they could put that on their resume and
CV.
So-